Morning. I appreciate the opportunity the elders give the members here every fifth Sunday to present a lesson. I usually appreciate that up until about the day before I have to do it. I don't appreciate it so much. This morning I'm going to be speaking on Israel's request for a king. In 1 Samuel chapter 8. Jimmy briefly touched on this last Sunday evening, but I thought of it first. No. I'm going to be taking some different points from those verses. Samuel, and everything I've read of Samuel, was a very faithful and upright man. We see in chapter 7 of Samuel his faithfulness, and we see how he gets Israel to take down their idols and turn from the false gods and turn their hearts back to the one true God. He pleads with the Lord to save them from the Philistines at Mizpah. And then, right in chapter 8, he appoints his sons, Joel and Abijah, as judges over Israel. Unfortunately, they don't follow in Samuel's footsteps. They take bribes. They pervert the justice. And they just don't stand upright. They abuse their power. And that's where I'm going to pick up our reading. In 1 Samuel 8, starting in verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." This idea of a king, I think, was already in the Israelites' mind. But they use the unfaithfulness, the sins of Samuel's sons as an excuse, as a reason for them to ask for the king. But why would a king, having a king, be against God's will? In verse 7, we see they're not rejecting. It's not the rejection of Samuel that's a problem. It's a rejection of God. God in Exodus 19:6 calls Israel a kingdom of priests, his people, his chosen people. God brought them out of Egypt miraculously through the plagues. And then when the Egyptians start chasing them, again, he miraculously saves them at the Red Sea. He feeds them all the way through the wilderness, brings them all the way to the promised land, this beautiful land flowing with milk and honey, and gives it to them. As long as they remained faithful, it was theirs for the keeping. And time again, they turned from him, this great king they had. Another problem with them requesting a king is their reasoning for it. They say that they want to be like the other nations. And then thirdly, they were basing the premise for this whole change they wanted for this king on the sins of men, on the sins of Samuel's sons. Can we make these same mistakes? Who is our king? Do we serve him? In Matthew 7, verse 21, it says, "Now everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven. But he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter." Are we doing his will? Are we of the world? Do we want to be like the other nations? In 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, "Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." We don't like to feel out of place. When you go somewhere, most people like to blend in, not draw attention to themselves. Being a Christian, we're going to stand out in this world. It's a dark world out there. And we're this light that's spoken about in Matthew 5:16. Thirdly, the Israelites use the sins of men as an excuse. We don't need to use the faults of men as an excuse for us to disobey the commands of our king. For example, maybe you don't like the Bible class teacher. "Well, I'm just not going to come to Bible class because I don't like that teacher, or I don't like that subject." Or maybe an elder does something wrong, and someone uses that as their basis for why churches shouldn't have elders. There's tons of different things that we can do where we use the sins of men or the faults of men as an excuse, as a reason not to serve God. People make mistakes. God never makes mistakes. That's who we need to base any decision on. I'd like to read Psalm 56. "Be gracious to me, O God, for man has trampled upon me. Fighting all day long, he oppresses me. My foes have trampled upon me all day long, for they are many who fight proudly against me. When I am afraid, I will put my trust in you. I shall not be afraid. What can mere man do to me? All day long, they distort my words. All their thoughts are against me for evil. They attack, they lurk, they watch my steps, as they have waited to take my life. Because of wickedness, cast them forth. In anger, put down the peoples, O God. You have taken account of my wanderings. Put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? Then my enemies will turn back in the day when I call. This I know, that God is for me. In God, whose word I praise, in the Lord, whose word I praise. In God I have put my trust. I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me? Your vows are binding upon me, O God. I will render thank offerings to you, for you have delivered my soul from death, indeed my feet from stumbling, so that I may walk before God in the light of the living." I just think that's a great psalm, and the trust David has in the Lord. It's the same kind of trust that we need to have. It's easy for us to look at Israel and think, how could they have rejected God so often, so many times? They were there. They saw all these great things. But they still wouldn't trust him. But don't we do the same thing? Every single miracle, everything he's done for us is right here. We've seen it all. We've seen everything. We've seen more than what the Israelites in the Old Testament saw. We've seen the full promise. But yet we still stumble. We don't trust in God. We're like Israel. Maybe worse. Why did Samuel have such trust? Every time Samuel felt rejected at this point, he was displeased. What did he do? He prayed to God. You see that so often. These great men were in constant communication with God. That's why they had such trust. They had a relationship with God. If I was to grab the yellow pages and flip to the section for chiropractors, pick one and go to them. And they told me, you're going to have major back surgery. Things are bad. I'm probably going to go get a second opinion. But if I go to Nick Shar, who I've known for 15 years, I have a great relationship with him. He's a great friend. I have trust in Nick. And if he were to give me some bad news, I would trust him. And I'd probably go ahead and do what he said needed to be done. Because there's that relationship. Do we have that relationship with God? In 1 Samuel 8, verse 9, it says, now then, listen to their voice. This is God speaking to Samuel. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. And that goes on, verses 10 through 18, to where Samuel tells the Israelites all these warnings of what a king is going to do. How he's going to take the people to work for him, take their land, take taxes. All these things for his feasts, his entourage, his everything that he has, he's going to take from the people. And for what? We go down to verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Once again, they bring up wanting to be like other nations. And they say they want a king to go to battle for them. You know, I imagine when Israel goes to battle, you know, you see in the movies these two armies come together and the kings ride out in front of their armies. They have the best horse, the polished armor. You know, it's some spectacular sight. Well, Israel don't have that earthly king. They have a judge. They're wanting this for show. Because their God, their king, could have defeated any other king. Israel wants to be like the world. The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. A book I read one time, Acres of Diamonds, it's by Russell H. Conwell. In it, there's a story of a man named Ali. He owned a large farm, fields of grain, had gardens, a family. He was wealthy and content, it says. And then one day a priest comes to him and starts talking to him about diamonds and tells him, if you had a mine of diamonds, you could put your sons on thrones, you would be the greatest man in the world. And in the book it says, that night he went to sleep a poor man, He still had the gardens. He still had the fields of grain. He still had his family. He had everything he had in the beginning of the day, but his thoughts were different. He then went on the next morning to sell everything and leave his family and go off to look for diamonds. He lives this nomadic lifestyle for some time until he's broke. Has nothing. He's left his family. And he kills himself. Well, the man that purchased those fields is taking his camel to some water in the garden. And he sees in the water a shimmer. He reaches down. He pulls out a black stone with an eye of light in it. He don't think much of it, and he goes and he sets it on the mantle in the house. Well, that same priest that had put the bug in Ali's ear comes to visit the successor. And he sees that up on the mantle, and he says, "Has Ali come back?" And he said, "No, he's dead." "Well, where'd the diamond come from?" So they go out, and they dig, and it says every shovelful had diamonds. And it says if Ali had stayed, if he had stayed in his own fields, kept his own family, he would have had acres of diamonds. We're here. We're in this great kingdom. We have everything we could ask for. All the diamonds we want. Do we look out there for our diamonds? Are we content with the great things we have here? Israel also wants a king to take responsibility for them. We should never give up our responsibilities, whether it be as a disciple, as a member of the congregation, as a parent, spouse, child. You name it, we each have responsibilities. As a member, you can read in Ephesians 4, verse 11. "And he gave some as apostles, and some as prophets, and some as evangelists, and some as pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of service, to the building up of the body of Christ." Each one of us has talents. Each one of us has things we can do as a member here, as a disciple of Christ. Whether it be greeting, welcoming visitors, preparing the communion, scripture reading, you name it. And we're all responsible for evangelizing and converting and encouraging one another. What about as a parent? Do you rely on the church to teach your children about God? Do you rely on the schools to teach your children the things they're supposed to know to survive out there? Those are tools to help us. But it's our responsibility as parents to teach our kids and to raise them the way we should. Don't give up your responsibilities in life for some assumed easier life. Who is your king? Who do you serve? And do you serve him and him only? It's easy to answer these questions here with this group, with fellow Christians. How do you answer it when you go outside the doors? Does your light shine out there? Do you ever hear people say to you, "You know, you're different. There's something different about you." Or, "Why don't you talk the way other people talk?" Do people notice these things? What do you say and what do you do when you leave this place? Would your king be pleased with the way you act when you leave? We need to trust our king. We need to trust in God. We don't need to make excuses for reasons not to serve him. Serve your king. Maybe you were in the kingdom before, but you've been struggling in your service. In just a moment, we're going to offer the invitation song. It'll be a great opportunity to get back in this wonderful kingdom. Or maybe you're not a part of that kingdom yet. And you're ready. You're ready to make those steps. Now's your opportunity while we stand and sing.